Today, I started talking about the theory of a free, real scalar field and general curve spacetime, and we found that we could make some progress on this question by taking the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation and writing it in terms of a special kind of basis. I didn't give that basis a name yesterday, or that type of basis a name yesterday, but it's convenient to do so, and I'm going to refer to bases of the interesting type as symplectic bases. Now, why is that? Well, the interesting property of the basis was that, roughly speaking, you could divide up the basis elements into two types. Oh. There are the ones that I've chosen to label by positive integers, and the ones that I've chosen to label by negative integers. The two parts are related by complex conjugation. And how do you know if a given basis element should be placed on the positive side or the negative side? Well, what we want is for things on the positive side to have Klein-Gordon inner product with their complex conjugates, which are minus 1, while for n less than 0, the Klein-Gordon inner product with the complex conjugate is plus 1. Okay. Now, in fact, these are the same statement because I'm also requiring the positive and negative guys to be related by complex conjugation. And if I complex conjugate this relation, I get this relation because the Klein-Gordon inner product is anti-symmetric. Okay. What we found was that if we have a basis of this kind, then that basis defines a state in the quantum theory of this scalar field. We can construct, using that basis, a certain state, which we are tentatively calling the vacuum state associated with that basis. We also found that if we have two different symplectic bases, U and V, that the vacuum states associated with U and V are related by a transformation of this form, something we could solve for. Note in particular, where these coefficients alpha and beta are determined just by taking the modes in one basis and decomposing them in terms of the modes in the other basis. Great. Something I didn't mention yesterday, but which is just worthwhile to know if you ever do explicit calculations, is that because I've imposed these normalization conditions on, well, in fact, any symplectic basis, and therefore on the elements of U and the elements of V, it turns out that these alphas and betas have to satisfy certain relations in order that they, in fact, preserve that normalization condition. If you work it out, it's just the statement that when viewed as matrices, alpha and beta satisfy this relation, alpha dagger alpha minus beta dagger beta is equal to the identity matrix. Right. Under such conditions, an interesting question is whether or not the normalization coefficient here is finite or not. And it turns out if you do the calculation, the normalization constant is given by this expression. This is not quite what I wrote yesterday, so please correct your notes. It's obviously something which is a function of alpha inverse times beta. And in fact, it's 1 minus the sort of norm of alpha inverse beta, the norm squared of alpha inverse beta, but then raised to the 1/4 power. However, if you then use this relation between alpha and beta, you find that you can collapse all this into some expression only involving the alphas. All right. Collectively, this whole story here, this transformation, this relationship between one symplectic basis and another, and the corresponding relationship between the creation annihilation operators and between these vacuum states is known as a Bogoliubov transformation. Again, a name I didn't mention yesterday, but which you should be aware of, because you will hear it a lot in discussions of quantum field theory and curved spacetime. So that was our story from yesterday. I don't know if there are any questions I should answer before I get started on the new stuff. In fact, it's not all that new. What I want to start off with today is talking about an example of when this kind of technology is useful. Okay. We'll start with a very simple illustrative example, and then we'll go for a second example as well. First I have another story to tell you. Again, what we did here is we took the space of solutions, and roughly speaking, divided it in half, because we took half, we have a basis for half the space of solutions associated with just the positive numbered modes, the ones that satisfy this relationship with a minus 1. And then the other half of phase of solution corresponds to the negative numbered modes, which satisfy this with a plus 1. Now, of course, the point is that, if you're given an arbitrary solution, and you want to know which half it falls in, all you have to do is compute its Klein-Gordon inner product with its complex conjugate. And if it's positive, then if you normalize it right, it'll be on one side. And if it's negative, then if you normalize it right, it goes on the other side. If it's zero, you should try again and choose a different solution to if you want to classify it into one of these two parts. What I wanted to mention is that this sort of split into the positive numbers and negative numbers is often called a split of the space of solutions, into positive and negative frequencies. Okay. Now, realize it's a slightly different set of words than we've used so far. What we've really talked about so far is, again, defining, splitting things into positive and negative in some sense, but positive and negative in terms of the Klein-Gordon inner product. So what's the relationship to this terminology that you will often hear? Well, it's very straightforward. Okay, it goes like this. Suppose that, at least locally, on some initial value surface sigma of the kind we use to define the Klein-Gordon inner product, this is a local statement in time. It might not be true at all times, but it's true near this hypersurface. Okay, suppose that on sigma, we have the relationship that if I take that normal derivative that goes into the Klein-Gordon inner product, and if I act on some solution u, suppose I get plus I omega times u. Okay. So what that means is that, roughly speaking, near this hypersurface, u is some solution which goes like e to the I omega t, with t being some coordinate that is constant on sigma. So rough. So this is the sort of rough translation. Here's the precise statement. Okay. Suppose that this is true. So in that sense, u is at least locally near sigma. This is usually called a negative frequency function. If it's I times a positive omega times t. Well, then by taking complex conjugates, the normal derivative of u star is just minus omega u star, okay? And now we can compute the Klein-Gordon inner product of u and u star. And what do we find? Well, the Klein-Gordon inner product, recall, is minus I in my normalizations times the integral over some hypersurface, which I will choose to be the one where this condition holds, because I can choose any surface. There's a measure factor, which is not critical. And then, of course, there's u times this bidirectional normal derivative and u star. Now, this is the interesting bit, because if I write this out, this is, okay, there's a minus I that carries over. Now, look what happens here. The normal derivative, when it acts on u star, since we're on sigma, is going to give me minus I omega. When it acts on u, well, of course, when it acts the other way, because of the definition of this double arrow creature, it has an inherent minus sign. But when it acts on u, the derivative gives me plus I omega. So when I take these two terms, one with the derivative acting here and one with it acting here, and bring them together, what I get is just minus 2I omega times the integral over sigma of, h sigma u times u star. Now this, of course, is just the L2 inner product and its positive definite. So what we see is that, let's see, there's a minus I here, there's a minus I there. So this entire creature, yes, I got the signs right, is something which is less than zero if u doesn't vanish on sigma. So what we see is that if u is a creature, is a solution, which is sort of locally positive frequency near some hypersurface, it will indeed satisfy u with u star is minus 1, and therefore will fall into the, be a positive numbered mode in our symplectic basis. in particular, what this tells us is that A sub U, as defined last time, is an annihilation operator while the other creature, A dagger U, which you recall is minus A U star, is a creation operator. So, if it's convenient to identify modes as being either positive or negative frequency, say in the local vicinity of some hypersurface, it will be a convenient way to tell you which of these operators become creation operators, which ones become annihilation operators. Okay? All right. So, with that as background, let's look at a simple example. Yes, question, please. If you do your homework, which is homework number one, you will in fact find that in general, these always exist. It's really just a matter of introducing local coordinates near sigma, okay, and then noticing that, See, is there a condition on sigma? Because I wrote it down differently in the homework. No. If you introduce local coordinates on sigma and you simply define a time coordinate t locally by taking it to be constant on sigma and then sort of running, measuring t along geodesics that run orthogonally from sigma, you'll find you can always do this. Yes. All right. But the important story for us is not what you can do to this in general, but that there will be many examples in which it is convenient to look at things this way. After all, this is not a fundamental definition. This is merely an observation that when you can divide things up into positive and negative frequencies near sigma, you know the answers. So let's look at an example. And I'll call this a qualitative example, because I'm not going to do any detailed calculations. Okay. What I want to do is to think about doing quantum field theory in the kind of universe that Mark Trodden has been talking about, a simple cosmological example. So let's think about one of the FRW universes. Remember, the FRW universes are described by being spatially homogeneous and isotropic, and all that happens is the scale of the spatial slices changes with time. So without writing down any formulas, I can tell you what the universe looks like by simply giving you a diagram showing A, the scale factor, versus the proper time, t. And I want to consider a simple example. I'll make it simple enough to be, in fact, unphysical, but still illustrate useful points. I want to consider the case where the scale factor is constant up until some time t1, and also constant after some time t2, but in between, the universe changes size. And I don't really care, well, it doesn't matter for this qualitative example exactly how it changes size. All right. So this example will allow us to clear up a few points that were raised in yesterday's discussion. See, the entire universe, of course, is time dependent. There is no time translation symmetry here, no global time translation symmetry, and therefore no always conserved notion of energy. However, there is a local time translation symmetry here. That is, in this region, d by dt is locally a symmetry. The universe is not changing at all. Similarly, up here, d by dt is, again, locally a symmetry. Okay. So what that means is that there is a useful notion of, say, the Hamiltonian for the system in both of these regions. Okay? That is to say, there is an operator that I will call H early, and a corresponding operator that I will call H late, with the following properties. If I take the commutator of H early with a field operator, okay, for t less than t1, so I take the commutator with a field operator in the early region, then I get just the usual, let's see, is there usual, it's minus I d by dt of phi. And similarly, for t greater than t2, there is some h late, such that h late with phi is minus I d by dt of phi. All right? So since we have a Hamiltonian and we have symmetries, okay, it might be natural to choose a symplectic basis of modes which is adapted to these local symmetries, right? So in other words, it's natural to consider modes, consider what I'll call the early symplectic basis, which has the property that all of the modes in this symplectic basis are eigenmodes of d by dt in the early region. In other words, it has the property that d by dt of un is equal to I omega I times some frequency, which will depend on the mode n, so I'll call it omega n, times un. Now, this may not be true globally, but it's true for t less than t1. And somewhere here, if I can fit it on the board and you can read it, I wish to put a subscript or a superscript early to remind me that this is for the set of early modes. Okay. All right. And of course, I'm going to set this up so that omega n is equal to minus omega minus n. Good. Now, it's also natural. Oh, yes. In fact, if I do this, it turns out that in terms of the associated creation annihilation operators, there's a simple expression for h early. I won't take the time to do the full derivation, but you can check this yourself. It turns out that if I simply write down the following obvious operator, the sum over n greater than 0 of omega n times the corresponding number operator, that is a dagger n, a n, and somewhere on here we'll try to write early as well to remind ourselves, okay? It is straightforward to check that if you commute this with a field operator at early times, you get minus I d by dt. To do that, you simply write out the expansion for phi in terms of these early modes, and once you've done that, as long as you're focusing on this region of space-time, you can forget about everything else, and it's just like the usual calculation you do in flat space to show that this operator is the Hamiltonian, meaning that it generates a time translation. Okay? Sure, why not? Because we certainly should. Good. Of course, it's also natural to think about what we could call u late, which is all the same story at late times, and in particular, such that dt u late n is equal to I omega n late u. With omega n, again, positive for n greater than 0. Okay, good. So, in this situation, symmetries suggest considering modes which are, as we say, eigenmodes of the time translation operator. But there are two different places we could apply that criteria. We could ask for eigenmodes at early time, or we could ask for eigenmodes at late time. And it's an interesting question to ask, is it possible to find any mode which satisfies both of these? That is to say, is it possible to take the early symplectic basis to agree with the late symplectic basis? Or will there be some difference between them? Okay. Well, it turns out the answer is that it's not possible for them to agree in general. And if you think about this the right way, it's fairly easy to see this result. So let's just go through that. What we're trying to do is really solve the Klein-Gordon equation. We want to say, suppose I give you a solution which happens to be positive frequency at the initial time, and then I evolve it forward. I want to ask, is it still positive frequency at the late time? Okay. Well, in my simple example of an FRW universe, I have preserved translation invariance in space, so it's natural to solve the Klein-Gordon equation by separation of variables. Okay, by which I mean look for solutions u of xt, which have one part I'll call u hat of t, and another part I'll call u tilde of x. Okay. Because of the translation invariance, it turns out you can find solutions that separate. And in fact, this behavior sort of the spatial modes all decouple in the usual kind of way. So what it means is that if I separate variables in the Klein-Gordon equation, I of course get one equation for u hat of t, and then a separate equation for u hat of x. Let's just look at the equation for u hat of t. Well, we know what it's going to look like because the Klein-Gordon equation is a second order equation. So it's got to have something that looks like d by dt squared of u hat of t. And then on the other side, we in general get some function of t, right? If we were in a space that had a global time translation symmetry, we just get a constant times u hat. But because the space-time will depend on t, you should expect time dependence on the right-hand side. So in general, we get something we can call minus omega squared of t times u hat of t. Okay. So this is an equation that you know a lot about, right? Because having written it this way, where it depends on only one variable, it's just like the Schrodinger equation in one dimension, right? So this is a kind of scattering problem. It's a kind of scattering problem where omega squared gives us a sort of potential. We start at small values of the time, at early time, with a mode that looks like e to the I omega times our one coordinate, which happens to be t, but which in quantum mechanics you would call x if this was the Schrodinger equation. And you want to ask, when this mode scatters through this potential, well, in general, you know that it's a combination of what in quantum mechanics you would call ingoing and outgoing mode. And only for very special potentials can you have modes that go straight through with no scattering. So in general, if I start with a mode which is positive frequency at early times, it becomes a combination of positive and negative frequencies at late times. Yes? Is that clear? Okay. So we conclude from this that indeed, in general, these two bases are different, and they're different in an interesting way. We mix up things that were called creation operators at early times. Well, a thing which is a... Let me write this on the board. In general, we find that something which we call the creation operator at early times is equal to some non-trivial combination of things that we call creation operators at late times, plus things that we call annihilation operators at late times. Right? And therefore, there is some non-trivial Bogoliubov transformation, and indeed, the two vacuum states are not equal. And in fact, in any given example, if I wrote down for you what this function actually was, you could imagine solving this scattering problem, calculating the corresponding Bogoliubov coefficients, and figuring out what one state is in terms of the other. Yes? Yes? Okay, there's a first derivative term in general as well. That's the friction term. Sure. Yeah, in general, there is also a first derivative term. Thank you. But you can still solve it the same way. Yeah, if you rescale this by an appropriate function of t, you can absorb this first derivative, and so you turn it into a Schrodinger equation type problem. But you're right. Technically, the level I've done it so far without rescaling that u hat, it's just exactly, it has that first derivative. Thank you. All right. So what we conclude is that what does this mean? That means that the state in which the universe has zero particles at early times is not the same state as the state in which the universe has zero particles at late times. Or in other words, if it happens that you start the universe with no particles in it, then during this expansion, particles will be produced. On the other hand, if you decide to choose a state because you, in order that the universe has no particles at late times, you will find that it had to have some particles present at early times, which, due to the interaction with the gravitational field, all get, well, sort of disappear, and we have left just a vacuum at late. All right. Note that this analysis doesn't tell us which state is the actual state of the real universe. It could be either one. Okay. Or, in fact, it certainly could be neither. Right? This is the usual story in quantum mechanics. You, of course, in addition to solving the Schrodinger equation, which is the Heisenberg equations of motion, you have to know something about the initial state of the universe in order to make a prediction. This is the same story here. We've just seen that there is this discrepancy, but without some additional input telling us what the initial state of the universe actually is, we don't know which, if either, of these states is physically correct. All right. It merely tells us that if indeed there's some reason, like possibly inflation that inflated everything away, that guaranteed that there were essentially no particles present at this time, then if the universe further evolves, particles can be produced. Very good. That's it for this example. Any questions? No? All right. In that case, let's go on to my next example. My next example is the most interesting one, and one that it's good to really cement into your mindset. I'm going to talk about what's called Rindler space, and this will take up most of the rest of the time in my lectures. Okay. So, what is Rindler space? Well, this is kind of a funny name, because what Rindler space really is it's just Minkowski space, but described a little bit differently than you do when you're first studying special relativity. Instead of considering inertial observers, we're going to consider Minkowski space as described by accelerating observers. Specifically as described by what are called uniformly accelerating observers. Okay. So first I simply remind you, here, this looks good. This is Minkowski space, t-axis that way, x-axis this way. Let me draw, for convenience, a light cone from the origin. Okay. Then I hope you're familiar with the idea that if I consider a uniformly accelerating observer in Minkowski space, their world line is a hyperbola which asymptotes to the light cone. In particular, one of these uniformly accelerating observers has, my notes are over there, but I can do this from my head, I think, follows a trajectory which is x squared, I'm going to try very hard to write my Minkowski coordinates as capital letters to distinguish them from something else which will come soon. All right, x and t, capital R. So, the uniformly accelerating observer follows a trajectory which satisfies x squared minus t squared, in units where c equals 1, of course, is equal to 1 over the square of the proper acceleration. Okay. So just in case you haven't seen this result, it should make intuitive sense, because after all, this world line is clearly accelerating and not inertial. And then how do I know that it's uniformly accelerating? Well, recall that Minkowski space has a boost symmetry, which has integral curves that look like this. This is a Lorentz transformation or a boost symmetry on Minkowski space, like so. And you see that this hyperbola, the supposed world line of our observer, is indeed one of the integral curves of that boost symmetry. So what that means is that since there's a symmetry that maps any given point on this world line to any other point, all intrinsic quantities computed at this point, like proper acceleration, for example, must match all intrinsic quantities computed at this point. Therefore, it's clear that the acceleration of this line is uniform. Yes? Okay. All right. Oh, let me grab my notes over here. Okay. So what's interesting about this story is that there are two natural classes of observers. Well, is that not only do we have the uniformly accelerating observers, but of course we also have the inertial observers. We like those too. So what we just said is that there are two interesting symmetries for Minkowski space. If you are an inertial observer, you might be more fond of the time translation symmetry given by taking capital T to T plus a constant. If you are a uniformly accelerated observer, then you find that there is some symmetry that preserves your world line, which is one of these boosts, which I will also call a Rindler time translation. Why do I call it a time translation? It's because in the region of space-time near our observer, it's a time-like symmetry. And in fact, as most of you probably know, but as also becomes apparent from this diagram, this region in which the Rindler time translation is both time-like and future-pointing is the only region of Minkowski space which is experimentally accessible to this observer. Because after all, these are light rays, which means that if an observer wants to find an event by, say, sending out a light ray and getting a return signal, actually performing some kind of experiment there, setting up initial conditions and collecting results, well, it's clear that if he wants to get a signal back, he must conduct experiments within this right, it's called the right Rindler wedge. By the way, how many of you are familiar with Rindler space? Good. All right. Well, those of you who are not familiar with Rindler space, let me just mention that these properties should be fairly clear, and these should remind you of things that you know and love about black holes as well. And indeed, this is why we're going to spend a lot of time working out this relatively simple example, because if we thoroughly understand Rindler space, then black holes and the Hawking effect can be done, at least at an intuitive level, in about half an hour or so. So we're going to do this carefully, and then we'll do the black hole. All right. So this is kind of like the study we just had, where in the cosmological evolution case, there we had two different symmetries that identified two different natural classes of modes, two different kinds of symplectic bases. Now, in the cosmology case, I set them up so that each symmetry was only approximate. But here, there are two exact symmetries, the Minkowski time translation and the Rindler time translation. So again, you might think that it's natural to consider two different kinds of symplectic bases. If you are an inertial observer, it might be natural, from a mathematical point of view, to use modes which are eigenmodes of d by dt. So let me write this down. I have a nice little chart. So if you're an inertial observer, it's natural to use eigenmodes of d by dt. Whereas if you're a uniformly accelerating observer, then it's natural to use eigenmodes of the Rindler time translation. Now, I should comment that at this point, all I've made is some statement of sort of mathematical naturalness, just assuming that whatever calculations this observer might like to do are best done using a basis of modes adapted to the symmetries that that observer sees, and similarly over here. Let me go through this story as is in terms of just what's mathematically natural, and then we'll interpret the physics when I'm done. Okay. So, what I'd like to do is to actually construct the full basis of modes and to compute the Bogoluchov transformation for you between them. Okay? That'll probably take up most of today, and then we'll interpret the physics of that transformation tomorrow. All right. So, in order to do a real computation, I'm going to need to write down some coordinates and some mode functions and so forth. Are there any general questions before I get started on this? Yeah, please. Okay, so far, I've only defined the operation of render time translation, which is the Boo symmetry drawn in this picture. I will now, in the next line, I will define the render time coordinates that I will use to do the calculations. Okay. All right, so that's my next step. I need a set of coordinates adapted to these render symmetries. And it's not so hard. You see, what's natural to do here is to just measure a time coordinate in terms of the parameter along these curves associated with the symmetry. Let's not worry about the details how that's defined, but the answer is that if you write Minkowski space, which we're used to thinking of this way, and here I'm doing just two-dimensional Minkowski space, it should be clear that the other dimensions sort of go along for the ride, but two dimensions is easier, and it lets me write shorter equations. Okay. I can write this in terms of a set of coordinates adapted to Rindler space as follows. I can write it as minus a constant kappa squared times x squared, that's a lowercase x, dt squared plus dx squared. Okay, so this is a lowercase x, this is a capital X. And what's the difference? So lowercase x is the, if I have some event here, the lowercase x coordinate is the proper distance along this line connecting the point to the origin. In other words, just the square root of x squared minus t squared. Okay. Similarly, this t is, it's actually the hyperbolic angle represented by this picture right there. Maybe it's worth just writing this out in case this is not familiar. Little x is the square root of capital X squared minus capital T squared. Little t has the property that its hyperbolic tangent of little t is equal to capital T over capital X. Great. And if you go through the detailed change of coordinate, you find the metric takes this form. Oh, wait. It's a constant kappa here. It goes here. It's natural to have such a constant because we might like our coordinates to have dimensions of length. And if I'm going to take the hyperbolic tangent of something, it should be dimensionless. So I should insert some constant here with dimensions of inverse length. Okay. Now, what does this constant allow us to do? Well, you see, t is going to be some coordinate that increases along each of these curves. All right. What we might like to do, if we have some particular uniformly accelerating observer, we might like to choose t not only to increase along his or her world line, but in fact, to actually measure proper time. That is, we might like the normalization of t to be such that it measures proper time along the world line of some particular observer. Okay. In other words, we might like to choose the constant kappa such that at whatever value of x our observer lives, this coefficient is 1. We might like to do so. Okay. So it's, if we have a uniformly observer at x, so if we have a uniformly accelerated observer at x, and therefore, with proper acceleration, 1 over x, as you can compute from that formula, it is natural to take kappa equal to 1 over, let's call this x0, 1 over x0, and therefore equal to alpha. Okay. So this constant kappa is sort of a way of saying that we could do the same calculation for various possible uniformly accelerating observers and understand how the result will depend on their acceleration. Okay? All right. Let's see. Yes, what's next? What's next is I want to write this metric in a more useful form. So as we all know, especially string theorists, if you work in two dimensions, every two-dimensional metric is conformally flat. And that's often the easiest way to write it. So let's make a transformation to write this conformally flat form. Let's introduce a new coordinate, rho, such that x is the exponential of kappa times rho. If we do this, then the metric becomes just kappa squared e to the 2 kappa rho minus dt squared plus d rho squared. Basically because we get one of these friendly factors of e to the 2 kappa rho, both from the x squared and from the dx squared part. Okay. Now to go one more step, what I'd like to do is to write this in terms of null coordinates. Okay? So I want to introduce coordinates v and u, v which is t plus rho, and u which is t minus rho. Except that, just to be careful, I want to do this on what I'm going to call r. What's r? R is the right wedge of this spacetime. Now, why do I want to do that? Why do I want to do something different on the right wedge than on the left wedge? Well, it's because what I'm eventually going to want to do with these things is define things like positive frequency, okay? Or worry about the Klein-Gordon inner product. The Klein-Gordon inner product involves a derivative in a time-like direction. But most importantly, it's a derivative in the future time-like direction. Uh-huh. Now, notice over here on our picture that the Ringler time translation is future pointing on this side and past pointing on this side. That means that if I'm really using the Ringler time coordinate t, which flows along with this symmetry, that it goes like this, and that on this side, t is a coordinate that increases towards the future, but in this side, little t is a coordinate that increases towards the past. Okay? What I'd like to do is to choose u and v to increase to the future on both L and R. So in order to do that, I need to insert an extra sign. And if I work on the left side, I want to define V to be minus T plus rho, and U to be minus T minus rho. That will guarantee that V and U are both, that dV and dU are both future pointing vectors, and I won't ever have to worry about these signs again as long as I do the algebra correctly. Okay. Is that clear? My eraser. Good. All right. So, with that understanding, I can write this metric in terms of the null coordinates. Ds squared is equal to this part here, minus dt squared plus d rho squared, is just going to be du times dv on both sides, because the extra minus sign will cancel. Actually, it's minus du times dv. And then there's the kappa squared. And then there's e to the 2 kappa rho. So that's e to the 2 kappa, and then either plus or minus d minus u, where it's plus on r and minus on l. Yes? All right. So now we have some nice coordinates which have a nice relationship to the Rindler symmetries. If I act with a Rindler time translation, incrementing t by a constant while holding rho fixed, then that increments both d and u, as long as we stay on the right Rindler edge. If we're on the left Rindler edge, increasing t decreases d and u. Okay. So, let's write down an interesting mode which would solve the equation of motion. Oh, and to make life easy on myself, I'm just going to specialize to the massless Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. That makes life easy because it means that solutions are things that are just functions of v or functions of u or linear combinations of the two. So let me just choose one particular mode of interest. I'm going to give this mode a name. I'm going to call this p sub r. The notation will make itself clear in a moment. So I want a mode which looks like e to the I omega v, where omega is some constant, so it's a nice simple mode. And this is going to be the case on the right side. Again, v is a coordinate which is slightly different on the right and on the left. Now, one of the interesting things about Minkowski space and Rindler coordinates, or just looking at these Rindler wedges, is that the right wedge and the left wedge are, as we noticed before, causally disconnected. So in particular, when you're looking at solutions to the equations of motion, I can specify initial data for the equations completely independently on the right side and the left side. And in fact, I can even solve the equation separately on the right side and the left side, because every point in the left Rindler wedge is space-like separated from every point in the right Rindler wedge. So in other words, I can make my life easy by thinking about just one wedge at a time. So I'm going to consider a mode which has this nice simple behavior on the right, but I can take it to vanish completely on the left side. Nothing wrong with that at all. All right. Good. So what I want to do, actually, with malice aforethought, to save myself copying lots of things, let me write this way over on this side. Great. Leaves me some space, and you should tip your nose to fill in a bit. So this is a mode which is positive frequency in the Rindler sense, right? If I act on it with d by d little t, the Rindler time, I get something which is just, oh, sorry, this is a negative frequency mode in the Rindler sense. Yes. Now it's a positive frequency mode in the Rindler sense. Help me treat the minus sign straight as we go on. All right. Our question is it also a positive frequency mode with respect to the Minkowski time? That is, if I looked at this basis of modes that we've said it's natural for our inertial observer to use, is this something which is also purely positive frequency, or does it have some negative frequency part? Aha. Well, to figure that out, let's express this in terms of the Minkowski coordinates. So in other words, I want to write this little v in terms of big V. Ah, now how do I do that? Well, the easiest way to do it is probably to stare at the metric. You could just go through the coordinate transformations. But this is the Minkowski metric, right? So you know that if I write the Minkowski metric in terms of, let's see, if I introduce v equals capital T plus x and u equals t minus x, then you know the metric takes the form minus du dv, right? Yes? Ah, do they have to agree at the origin? Well, that's all a question of how smooth I want my solution to the equations of motion to be. One of the nice things about working in two dimensions of the massless wave equation is that you can say that an arbitrary function of f, an arbitrary function along null planes gives you a solution to the equation of motion, even if it's not smooth. So I don't really have to worry about that. But you're right, in some more proper treatment, I might go through and worry about making wave packets out of these things. It has some nice behavior at the origin. I could make them smooth. Okay. But in fact, it's one of these things that, because what we're really interested in is a kind of L2-like structure, right? I mean, the Klein-Gordon inner product is not positive definite, but it's the same kind of creature. Smoothness is not a crucial consideration to take into account. Okay. All right, so I want to figure out what's the relationship between little v and big V, and it's fairly clear from just writing the metric, right? Because in order for this transformation to take place, it should be, if one thinks about the structure of null rays, it's clear that capital V is in fact only a function of little v and doesn't depend on little u. That's because v is a right-moving null coordinate, and little v is a right-moving null coordinate, and so is capital V, okay? So the only way this is gonna work if this metric is equal to this metric is if, in particular, I'll do it on the side, so I don't screw up my order here. Okay, so the only way that this equation can hold is if indeed V capital V, is equal to kappa E to the kappa plus, or, let's call it plus or minus kappa V, where again, whether you choose plus or minus depends on whether on the right wedge or the left wedge. So as a result, if I just integrate, if I integrate this, capital V is just plus or minus e to the plus or minus kappa V with, again, plus on the right, minus on left. Okay. So I can then write this in terms of the capital V coordinate, because little v is equal to plus or minus 1 over kappa times the logarithm of plus or minus capital V. Oh, you know what? By a convention, I'm going to remove that annoying sign and put it here, which just means I'm choosing du to be plus or minus, to have the same sign with it, so it cancels, like so, du. And it turns out this is the right convention to choose if we again want capital V to be a coordinate that increases toward the future. Okay? Just think about it. What we want is for both little v and big V to increase towards the future. Oh, shoot. I guess I did want that sign there. Never mind. Good. Yes. Done this way, they both increase in the same direction, right? Yeah. Right. That's what it means if there's no sign here in the difference. Okay. Anyway, at the moment, we only need to work on one side because our mode is only non-vanishing on the right. So if I write this in terms of capital V, what do I get? I get the exponential of minus I omega times, I'm on the right side, the sign is plus, 1 over kappa times the logarithm of capital V, like so. Yes. Good. All right. So our question is, is this something which is purely positive frequency in terms of capital V? And if not, what is its negative frequency part? Okay. Well, we could compute this just by Fourier transforming this expression with respect to capital V. That would give us the components at all frequencies. However, there's a nifty trick that was shown to us by Bill Unruh, which makes the calculation very straightforward, so we're going to follow the nifty trick. The idea is this. Suppose we did compute the Fourier transform this guy. Suppose we tried to compute the integral. Oh, let me do one more thing. Well, actually, I don't need to do it yet. Suppose we wanted to compute the integral dv of e to the I, let's call it omega tilde, capital V, against our mode. Okay. We'd like to do this calculation. That's the Fourier transform that just tells us what the component is at each frequency. Okay. Well, at least this part is a nice analytic function. So if this part, actually, let me not call it, let me give it some more general name, like f. If this part was also a nice analytic function, it would be tempting to try to evaluate this by deforming some kind of contour. So in particular, if we look at the complex v-plane, so this is the real part of capital V, and this is the imaginary part of capital V, then what we find is, of course, that if I look off here at positive imaginary values, this bit here decays rapidly. E to the I omega capital V goes rapidly in this direction to zero. Right? So if it was the case that F was also an analytic function that died off in the complex plane, in the upper complex plane, I would be able to take my integration contour here, deform it off the plus infinity, and find the answer is zero by using Cauchy's theorem, right? Okay. Similarly, if it would, okay, great. Oh, sorry. This decays in this direction for omega tilde greater than zero. Okay. So, in other words, if F was something that was analytic in the upper half plane, I would find that this vanishes for all positive omega. In other words, if F is analytic in the upper half plane, oops, for imaginary part of V greater than zero, and dies off sufficiently fast towards infinity, then it would follow that F is entirely either positive or negative frequency. Let's see, I would only get a non-zero answer if this was minus, if this omega tilde was negative, and that means that F would be composed of things with the complex conjugate with positive omegas, so that should be negative frequency. Let's see, does that match my notes? Analytic in the, where are we? Analytic in the upper half plane, it means that the positive frequency part is zero and F is pure negative frequency. Good, that's what I wrote. Okay, excellent. Similarly, if F is analytic in the lower half plane, F is purely positive frequency, right? Okay. So now, what we should do is think about this function and decide to what extent it's analytic. And of course, the answer is it's really not analytic. Notice that it vanishes somewhere, and it doesn't vanish somewhere else. It vanishes on the entire left Rindler wedge. And any function which is zero over a large interval and is not zero someplace else is not analytic. Right. Just to help you sort this out, let's recall the coordinate V is capital T plus capital R. So this here, this light ray, is the line, shoot, it's getting busy, capital V equals zero. And on the right wedge, we have capital V is greater than zero. On the left wedge, we have capital V is less than zero. Okay? So again, what we have here is a function which is clearly not analytic because it vanishes for negative values and does not vanish for positive values. Right? However, the cute trick is that there is a closely related function, actually two of them, that are analytic. So let's consider the expression, which I am going to call capital P. That one was lowercase p sub r. Capital P is the expression which is the exponential of I omega over kappa times the logarithm of minus v. Oh, that's, I know what that is. Logarithm of v on the right wedge, which is capital V greater than 0. And on the left, so it, in other words, this is equal to the mode we had before on the right wedge. Okay? What we're going to do is choose it differently on the left wedge. On the left wedge, we'll choose it to be e to the minus pi omega over kappa times this expression, exponential of I omega over kappa times the logarithm of capital V for V less than 0. Now, if you look closely, you'll see that what I've done is simply take the expression on the right side, keep it the same, and then to analytically extend this function to V less than 0 by placing the branch cut for the logarithm here, somewhere in the upper half plane. Right? If I analytically continue a logarithm from positive V to negative V, then what happens? The logarithm shifts by log V goes to log V plus I pi. And when that I pi hits I omega over kappa, it gives me this factor, e to the minus pi omega over kappa. So this function, which is similar to what we started with, but different, is analytic in the upper half plane, and therefore purely negative frequency. Ooh, why did I call it P? No, I lied. I misspoke. As I said, I placed the branch cut here. So it's not analytic in the upper half plane. It's analytic in the lower half plane. And therefore, it is indeed purely positive frequency, as the notation might lead you to guess. OK? All right. Very good. So notice that P is therefore just the mode we started with, plus another piece that I'm going to call N sub L. What is N sub L? N sub L is simply 0 on the right wedge. And this business, actually, let me write it this way. It's e to the minus pi omega over kappa times N sub L, where N sub L is the rest of it, the exponential of I omega over kappa log capital V on the left side. And now, if we translate this back from capital V to little v, we find that everything is the same except for this minus sign here. Actually, there's also this minus sign, but no one stopped to correct me when I tried to claim that it's, when I'm taking the log of a negative number here, this is minus sign hit me here. So anyway, the important difference is now going to be this minus sign. So when I translate this back to little v, I now get e to the plus I omega v on r. So you see the reason for this notation. This n sub l is a mode which is supported, on l. It's a mode which is supported on the left Rinder wedge and vanishes on the right Rinder wedge. It has the property that, in the Rinder sense, it is purely negative frequency. Yes. Okay. So at least for one particular mode, we have found how to express a purely positive frequency mode with respect to the Minkowski time translation in terms of a positive frequency piece and a negative frequency piece with respect to the regular time translation. Okay. But it's in fact clear that by simply doing the same thing for all values of omega, we cover all possible modes. Well, okay, we do it twice. We do it once for the V modes and once for the U modes. It's the same kind of story. Okay. So what does this mean? This means we can read off from this expression those alpha and beta coefficients in the Bogoliubov transformation. In this, what you see here is that the alpha coefficients are all more or less, are all essentially one, once we keep track of proper normalizations, which I'm not going to calculate for explicitly here. Whereas the betas have this interesting factor of e to the minus pi omega over kappa. There's also this interesting phenomenon that the alpha mode connects the inertial mode with a Rindler mode on the right side, whereas the beta coefficient connects the inertial mode with a Rindler mode on the left side. Okay. All right. So what this means is that, how am I doing? Oh, I've got lots of time. Our solution for the Bogoliubov transformation was as follows. It tells us that if we write the vacuum state picked out by the Minkowski modes, that is, picked out by the modes that are eigenmodes of the Minkowski time translation, if we write this in terms of the zero particle state picked out by the Rindler modes, okay, the relationship is in general the exponential of minus 1/2 the sum over m to n, alpha inverse beta, m n, alpha dagger, n, alpha dagger, m, where these are the Rindler mode creation annihilation operators. Okay. If we evaluate this in this case, what do we get? Minus 1/2. Well, let's look at this. So I didn't worry about the normalization coefficients for p and n, so I haven't really computed alpha and beta explicitly. But n and p, which I've now erased, are very similar looking creatures, just replacing v with minus v and l with r. They're related by a symmetry. So the normalization factors are the same for both. So although we haven't yet worried about factors of 2 pi and so forth that would tell us what the right normalizations are, and therefore exactly what alpha and beta are, it's clear that alpha inverse times beta, or beta divided by alpha, is indeed just e to the minus pi omega over kappa with some kind of matrix structure. Okay? So, sum over modes. And what does the matrix structure do? Well, see, okay. Alpha and beta are both matrices. The story is that alpha is a matrix that goes here. So alpha has two matrix indices. I'll just call them by dots. I don't want to put labels there. But one of them tells us which Minkowski mode we're computing on the left side. And the other matrix index tells us which Rindler mode we're connecting to here. Similarly, beta has two matrix indices, one of which tells us which Minkowski mode we're computing here, and one of which tells us which Rindler mode we're connecting to. Now, in this matrix product, well, we want to connect, we want to add up things that involve the Rindler creation operators. So what we must be doing is keeping free here the matrix indices on alpha inverse and beta, which correspond to the Rindler modes, and in this matrix product, we're summing over the Minkowski modes, right? So to write down the final expression here, all we have to do is figure out, okay, if I start at some given Rindler mode, connect it to a Minkowski mode, and then come back to the negative frequency Rindler's mode, what did that map do? You see what it did? It just takes this PR to NL. So in other words, what appears here, you may do the calculation in detail as a homework assignment. What appears here is merely the sum over N, one integer, of, let's call it N right dagger, N left dagger. Okay. The fact that this expression involves a positive frequency right mode, a positive frequency mode on the right wedge, and a negative frequency mode on the left wedge, means that in this expression, these creation operators always come in pairs, one on the right wedge, and the corresponding mode, just related by the symmetry that relates NL and PR, on the left wedge. Okay. So I hope, even if you didn't follow the detailed, let's call it a derivation of that result, that the result makes intuitive sense, because what we see here again is that when you break a inertial positive frequency mode into Rindler positive and negative frequency pieces, you get one piece on the right side and a corresponding piece on the left side. All right. So, okay. Yes, please. Shouldn't I make what inside the sum? Oh, yeah, thank you, good. Indeed, omega depends on, omega depends on N, so I should indeed put that inside the sum, mode by mode. E to the minus, what was it again? Omega N pi over kappa. Okay. Perfect. So what we see is then, if I take the vacuum state, the Minkowski vacuum state, which we know is the lowest energy state in terms of the energy defined by the Minkowski time translation, and if I look at it in terms of the symplectic basis naturally associated to the Rindler symmetry, that it is not the vacuum state. It's full of particles. If I expand out this exponential, I get lots of pairs of Friesian operators acting on the vacuum. So what this says is that, in fact, it's full of correlated pairs of particles on the right and left sides. Right? Every time I when I expand out this exponential, every time I create a particle on the right side, on the right Rindler wedge, I also create one on the left Rindler wedge. So again, so for example, if I expand this out, I get a term which is just the Rindler vacuum, and then I get a two-particle state, which is a sum over two particle states that have one particle on the left, on the right, and one on the left, and then I get also a four particle state, etc. Yes. Okay. Good. This, by the way, carries a deep message about quantum field theory, which is just that, if indeed we try to do something that one of your fellow students warned me not to do, if we try to deal with the right and left Rindler wedges separately without worrying about making modes match at the origin, if we try to sort of divide space into two pieces, okay, then we find that the vacuum state doesn't really like that decomposition, and the vacuum state contains correlations, these multi-particle correlations, between the left and right sides. It's just another another way to see the familiar statement that intrinsic in the vacuum state of quantum field theory are a lot of correlations at space-like separations. All right. Oh, good. I've got 15 minutes to go. Good. Okay. So, so far, I've been treating this as a mathematics problem. What I said is there are two different kinds of symmetries that are interesting. And therefore, you might be interested in using one kind of symmetry, in which case, in studying one kind of symmetry, in which case it's natural to use eigenmodes of that symmetry. Or you might be interested in studying a different kind of symmetry, in which case it's natural to use eigenmodes of that symmetry. And then we related to various definitions of particle and vacuum state. All right. Now, where's the physics? Well, the physics comes in when I give you a physical quantity to compute, and then we figure out how to use one of these two choices to get the answer in a simple way. So here's the interesting point. Let's consider any observable, something made out of the field operators. So in fact, I'll say that, built from phi of x on the right Rindler wedge. Anything at all, any observable in space-time, as long as it's localized on the right wedge. So what are some examples of such things? Well, it might be, so example one, maybe I'd choose to compute a number operator built out of the right Rindler mode. So something which is just a combination of Rindler creation and annihilation operators. If I can, this R means right, not Rindler. So it's right, actually right Rindler. In terms of, if you work out the expressions in terms of the field operators, because the right Rindler modes are concentrated on the right side, the associated creation annihilation operators are also built only from field operators on the right side. So such a number operator would qualify. It's something which is built only from phi of x on R. That's one example. What's another example? Well, it might just be that I consider O, which is the integral of phi of x, f of x, for some test function f over the space-time, with f of x non-zero only on R. So the sort of space-time average of a field, which just happens to be located over on the right. Here's a region of space-time, I average over it. I emphasize that this is a quantity, the average value of the field, that either our inertial observer or our uniformly accelerated observer might be interested in. But let me make a third choice, which is more related to the choice of observer. I might, for example, be interested in computing example number three. I might be interested in doing something related to, for example, experiments the Rindler observer might carry out. So I hope you're used to the idea that in quantum field theory, if you study, say, the LSZ formalism and so forth, when you do scattering experiments, these are related to correlation functions in the vacuum, right? Or correlation functions in the state of interest. So if I imagine doing an experiment, and if I imagine that the uniformly accelerated observer is doing an experiment, that means they'll be interested in some correlation function. Well, they'll be interested in having particle detectors and emitters, which they carry along their world line, because this is the person doing the experiment. So that means they'll be interested in a correlation function measured somewhere along their world line. Well, a correlation function measured along this world line is indeed entirely built from field operators in the right Rindler wedge. So let's write down an example of that. It might be that I integrate, let's say I integrate twice to get a well-defined answer, where both of the things I integrate over are on the uniformly accelerating world line. So these are one-dimensional integrals. If you like, we could call them integrals over the sort of well, it doesn't matter what the parameter is. Let's just call them integrals over the world line. They're one-dimensional integrals. And perhaps I'm interested in, as I say, a correlation function, phi of x times phi of y. And why not? Let's have some kind of test functions, arbitrary f and f prime, which just weight the integral d, it doesn't matter what measure we use, let's just say d world line and d world line prime. Okay, great. So this becomes a correlation function if I take its expectation value in the Minkowski vector. Then it becomes the integral over the world lines of the correlation function phi of x, phi of y, f of x, f prime of y. All right. Good. All right. So we want to consider any such quantity, which in particular would include any kind of natural measurement or observation that our Ringlerbs or observer can do. Okay. So what I would like to do is simply schematically calculate the expectation value of these observables. Okay. But I want to do it, it turns out to be convenient to calculate the expectation value using this Ringler description. So let's do that. It looks a little bit long, but it gives an interesting answer. So again, I'm going to just calculate the expectation value in the Minkowski vacuum state, okay? I mean, in this case, we can discuss, we will discuss more next time why this is so, but it seems clear that if you had to choose a natural quantum state for this space-time, the Minkowski vacuum is in some sense a more natural quantum state than the Ringler vacuum, in part because it has more symmetries. Right? The Minkowski vacuum is something that we talked about here as having a Minkowski time translation symmetry, while the Ringler vacuum had a Boost symmetry or a Ringler time translation symmetry. But the Minkowski vacuum we know has more symmetry. Not only is it invariant under a Minkowski time translation, it's also invariant under a space translation. And in fact, it's also invariant under the Ringler boost. Okay. So if there's any question here about which is a more natural state, it's certainly likely to be this one. Again, next time we'll talk about this in more physical terms, but let's just start with this as motivation. So I'm calculating a usual kind of expectation value, but just for particular observables, observables supported on the right Ringler wedge. And you will see in a moment that it's interesting to use the Ringler expression for this. So I will write it in terms of the Ringler vacuum. And now, exponential of, let me just write this schematically, 1/2 alpha inverse theta, a dagger, oops. Actually, AA, there are no daggers here because I took the Hermitian conjugate of this state in order to write it as a product. Let me pause to do one thing, though, in my schematic notation, which is to remind me that in these pair of annihilation operators, one of them is associated with the right Ringler wedge, and one is associated with the left Ringler wedge. Over here, I have minus 1/2 alpha inverse theta A dagger R, A dagger L, acting on the Ringler vacuum again. Okay. Now, what you would do to proceed with this computation is to expand out this exponential and then try to do various contractions of creation annihilation operators. Now, some of this is hard and some of this is easy. The point is that since the operator O, by assumption, is located in the right Ringler wedge, whereas anything with an L subscript is localized in the left Ringler wedge, we notice that O commutes with the left annihilation operators, oops, and also with the left annihilation operators. So no matter what this O is, I could expand out this exponential and this one and go ahead and move all of these left annihilation operators all the way over here to the right and simplify the expression. The right operators are harder to move because they will interact with O. Okay? But the left ones I can move through. So let me write this in a little bit different way in order to explain what this calculation is that we're doing. It turns out to be useful to think about this expectation value here. Instead of writing Minkowski out, it's just M, because I'm starting to run short of time now. Let me think about this as the trace of the operator given by multiplying O by this rather simple density matrix. Right, this is the same expression by a trivial rerun. Okay. But now, the point is that if we write this out in terms of this Rindler description, well, what does this trace mean? It trace means you sum over all the states in the Hilbert space. But in the Rindler description, the Hilbert space factors into two pieces. So this is a trace over the Hilbert space, which in the Rindler description is a direct product of a Hilbert space on the right Rindler wedge with a Hilbert space on the left Rindler wedge. What we've just said is that when I take this expression here and substitute it in here, okay, this operator O doesn't care at all about the left Rindler wedge, and therefore I can go ahead and take the trace over the left part without caring about O. In other words, this is equal to a trace, which is a trace only over the right Rindler wedge, of O times a different density matrix rho, with rho being a trace over just the left Rindler wedge of the Minkowski vacuum with the Minkowski vacuum. Okay? Good. All right. So, this is something that we, in principle, could calculate. And in fact, I've left the detailed calculation to your homework assignment because, again, it involves just pushing around creation and annihilation operators. But when you do the calculation, which I encourage all of you to do, the result is very interesting. The result is, and I'll write this down quickly, then we'll stop. Well, if you actually do this calculation, it's easiest to work in some kind of basis. So let's imagine I'll tell you what rho is by telling you its matrix elements in terms of some kind of n particle state. So let's suppose I have n1 particles in mode 1, n2 particles in mode 2, up to nk particles in mode k. And I want to compute the matrix element of rho between this state and a similar state with n1 prime, n2 prime, nk prime. Well, the first thing you find if you do this calculation is that it's diagonal. You only get a non-zero element if n1 and n1 prime agree, n2 and n2 prime agree, nk and nk prime agree. Okay. And then what's the coefficient of this Kronecker delta? So these, by the way, just to remind you, these are occupation numbers for right modes, and these are occupation numbers for right modes, because we've already traced over all the left modes, so rho doesn't know anything about those. Okay. So what's the coefficient? Well, the coefficient turns out to be the exponential of, well, I mean, the only scale in this problem is this number, which is now off the board, which is too bad. Remember that alpha inverse times beta was e to the minus pi cap, pi omega over kappa, right? So you should expect that number to come up again, and indeed it does. What comes up here is exactly e to the minus 2 pi over kappa. So it's 2 because I took 2 Minkowski states, put them together, so that squared that factor. And omega, well, omega depends on which mode we have. We have lots of modes running around here, so it shouldn't surprise you to see a sum, say from j equals 1 to k, of the occupation numbers times the frequency, like so. Now you notice that this is just the energy of this state. So here what you find if you do this calculation is the matrix elements of the density matrix are diagonal with entries given by the exponential of the energy times some coefficient. In other words, if I calculate the expectation value of any observable localized on the right side, I can do it by taking this trace against the density matrix, which is nothing other than the exponential of minus 2 pi over kappa times the Rindler Hamiltonian. This is indeed the Rindler Hamiltonian. That's what a Hamiltonian looks like. Okay. And what is this? This is just exactly a thermal state with temperature equal to kappa over 2 pi. All right. And we already mentioned that if we wish to interpret kappa in terms of the proper acceleration of our uniformly accelerated observer, this is alpha over 2 pi. So we have now done the calculation for what is known as the Unruh effect, and we'll talk about the physics of this next time. Well, sorry, we did part of the calculation, and this last bit, the trace over the left Hilbert space, I've left for your homework assignment. Okay. But you see, this is the source of the statement that we'll understand more fully next time, that any experiment performed by the Rindler observer, like, for example, a computation of a correlation function giving the results of experiments producing and detecting particles along his or her own world line, the result of any such experiment is the same as if, the result of any such experiment done in the Minkowski vacuum state is the same as if the Rindler observer were surrounded by a thermal state, a thermal bath of particles with temperature given by the proper acceleration divided by 2. We've more or less done the calculation today. We'll talk more about the physics, I guess, tomorrow morning at 9:30. Okay? Thanks a lot.